Good evening, everybody. We have the good fortune of having a Haftorah that is very rarely read. So in most other years, we wouldn't be able to get to have a chance to do this. But actually, if you've been noticing that even when we have a preempted Haftorah, I do the regular one. So the Tetzaveh Haftorah would be discussed even if it were to be Shabbos Parsha Zohar, which it usually is. This Haftorah is from Yechezkel, Perek Mem Gimel. I gave that to you on page 1, right? But in order to fully appreciate what Yechezkel is trying to do here, I want to do a few other prophecies as well in some other places in Tanakh, okay? So we have to become familiar with a few other Nevi'im, all right? And some of those Nevi'im are here in these sources. I just want to point out a few important points first. One, Yirmiyahu in 2 separate chapters made a prediction of a 70-year waiting period. Most people are aware of a 70-year waiting period from the Churban Beit HaMikdash until the rebuilding of the next Beit HaMikdash, from the Churban of the first temple to the building of the second temple. But Yirmiyahu gave another 70-year cheshbon. The 70-year cheshbon that from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, 70 years later, another nation would destroy them. And if we could only hold out and remain in Israel long enough for the fall of Bavel, that other nation will be kindly disposed to us. The prophet Yeshayahu had before this already mentioned that king by name. His name is Koresh, Cyrus. And that we'll be able to return to the land and rebuild the land to its original splendor, even a greater splendor. Alas, the Jews did not heed this call. They didn't surrender to the Babylonians who would have let them stay. They were exiled in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. They were exiled again in the time of Jehoiachin, 597. They were exiled in 586. And they were exiled again when Gedaliah was assassinated. Then Yirmiyahu himself was carried off to Egypt. I mean, there's so many strikes here against Bnei Israel. Add to this the problem that life for the Jews, and even in Bavel, the Jews, like, they felt they made it in Bavel. What's the sign that the Jews made it in the exile? Is that the local women are willing to marry the Jewish men, right? Rampant assimilation existed in Bavel to the point that even the Kohen Gadol's own 2 sons were intermarried in Bavel. Then, to make matters worse, the Jews were fully accepted in Persia. But you know, there's a fine line between fully accepted and a decree from a man named Haman. Right? The Jews were far more accepted, Jenny, tell me if this is your experience, Jenny Michael, in Germany in 1930 than in America in 1930. Right? America was a hotbed of anti-Semitism after World War I. The Jews often can go very quickly, pit'om, like Vayakom Melech Chodosh, and then there's a whole new situation facing us. So the Jews in Persia understood this when Haman's decree came in, but before then and after then too. I mean, after Haman was defeated, Mordechai is the Mishneh LeMelech. He's second in charge. Imagine that. And a Jewess is a queen, is the queen. You know, the Jews had no real incentive to leave a painful diaspora to a land of Israel. Adraba, living in Israel then was painful, and living in the diaspora was quite satisfying for the Jews. Yechezkel, in what will be the Haftorah of Parshas Parah that we'll be discussing a few weeks from now, understands that no Jew would purposely choose to live in the Chutz Laretz. If Jews are living in the Chutz Laretz, it's because the host nation is forcing them to remain there. Okay, so that is a little background from Yirmiyahu. And I wanted to give a little further background from Sefer Daniel. Okay. This is on page 5. Take a look at page 5, which is Daniel chapter 9. Daniel Perek Tes. Just read a few psukim. Okay. Daniel Perek Tes starts off. Look at that, the son of Achashverosh. Achashverosh is mentioned in 3 books of Tanakh: Esther, Daniel, and Ezra. If it's all the same Achashverosh, then it would appear that of the 10 kings of Persia, that Achashverosh is either Artaxerxes the first or Xerxes. Okay, Chashrash. The end of the book. So I looked into the old books and I saw that it says that 70 years after the destruction was supposed to return. Sounds a little like a pasuk in Esther, right? Mm-hmm. Because I saw that the 70 years are up. Nothing's happening. The Gemara in Megillah makes a cheshbon that Achashverosh also made a 70-year cheshbon. But he started from the wrong date. He started from the Buchadnezzar's year. And when he saw that the 70 years were over in his third year and the Jews aren't going anywhere, he threw a party. And the Jews enjoyed this party. Not just that they attended because they felt they had to. They enjoyed it. Shenehenu misudas Achashverosh. Right? Terrible yetzer hara of taking part in the local festivities. Right? The festivities of Esther Perek Aleph seems to mention quite a bit of like references to elements that have reminders of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan. Colors, the description of the pageantry and the ostentation, right? The Tiferes and the Tcheles and the Argaman and the Chavle Butz and all these words that are used in Torah and Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim describing the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. And the fact that it says they use the kelim, the kelim, kelim shonim, v'yemachus rav ki adam melech. What's so sad about the fact that it says that the Achashverosh was using kelim to drink from, that we should lay in it nechatrap? Because the Gemara says that they were using the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. All right. So Daniel is also expressing this confusion in chapter 9 as well as chapter 12. He tells God, I don't know when this is all to come to an end. I pose a question to you that I'll transfer to Yechezkel, to our Haftorah shortly. When Daniel was talking about not being sure when the end was going to happen, which end was he talking about? An end that we are still looking forward to, meaning Kate's Mashiach, or an end of the current galus that they were in? What's the pshat? Wouldn't it, do you think it's the current galus? He said, I looked at Yirmiyahu's cheshbon, supposed to be 70 years. The 70 years are close to being up, and nothing's happening. No one's astir. No one's saying anything. Yeah, because you're making the wrong cheshbon. The cheshbon of 70 years that's happening now is related to the end of the Babylonians and the beginning of the Persians. Right? This other cheshbon of 70 years is yet to happen.
What it happens was all the dates. With all the dates, the same story. Something is wrong. You see,
something. The thing that's wrong is that
yes, it's always.
In the exile, these things became very confusing, and you're absolutely right. We're not supposed to announce a specific time. We're supposed to say the Alpha Pishi Ismamea im koze achakelo bechol yom shiavo. It's bechol yom. Each and every day is the day that's what. Not supposed to like say, okay, 24 years from now, like Shabtai Tzvi did. You know, they said right now this is what it is. So the point is that although we do look to the end of Daniel to define certain elements of our future redemption, right? Yishlach l'keitz hayomin. You ever see in Yigdal? It's Yishlach l'keitz hayomin l'mashicheinu. Why keitz yomin? Keitz yomin with a mem. Because the end of, look at the last pasuk in Daniel. If you were just in chapter 9, look at chapter 12. It says l'keitz yomin. Those are the last two words in Sefer Daniel. L'keitz yomin. Right? Some say it refers to the cates of God's promise that he made with his right hand, that we will be redeemed. Right? You can be sure of this. Christians also use the end of Daniel to prove the arrival of what they claim their Messiah is. So it can be confusing, and a biblical text can be manipulated in many different ways. I'm just saying. But pshat is pshat, chevra. Daniel was talking about the end of his own time. End of the gullus of the 70 years. He says so. He says so in chapter 9. So I'm willing to accept as pshat also that chapter 12, where he continues on this theme, is referring to an additional redemption. Fair enough. Do you see what I'm getting at? When Yechezkel talks in the last 9 chapters of his book about a renewed Beis HaMikdash, what is it? Is he talking about Bayis Sheni, or is he talking about Bayis Shlishi? Is he talking about the second temple or the third temple?
Bayis Sheni.
Can it be both? Is it possible? Let's see. So here is what Yechezkel is the first 39 chapters of Yechezkel, very harsh prophecies. He mostly acts out prophecies to be symbolic of things that will take place to his people. And the last 9 chapters of his book, he tells us how to rebuild the temple. So again, I ask you, which temple is he talking about? The second temple or the third temple? So this is a debate amongst the commentaries. I'll tell you a generality. Ibn Ezra, the Pashtan, always says it's the second temple. Yechezkel didn't dream about a third temple. When the second temple was built, they didn't expect there to be a third temple. There may be some prophecies that are interpreted, like B'chot Yivkeh B'alayla, where the Medrash in Eicha Rabba says Yirmiyahu was crying for Bechol, this temple, Tivkeh, another temple is going to be destroyed on the same day of Tisha B'Av. Even if Yirmiyahu was aware of that, I can't believe that he would express that to the masses. They wouldn't. Why would they bother building this one if they felt it was going to be destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So these last chapters of Yechezkel are about rebuilding the temple. The Rambam writes in the laws of Hilchos Beis HaBechira, the laws of the temple, he says that when it comes time to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, we're going to use a whole series of texts. We're going to use Shmos, we're going to use Malachim, we're going to use Divrei HaYomim, we're going to use Meseches Midos, and Mishnah and Mishnayos, and Shas, and we're going to use Sefer Yechezkel to determine how to rebuild the temple. Okay? So when we read, when last week we read Parshas Truma, which begins the description of the building of the Mishkan, so there's a natural place in Nevi'im to have as the Haftarah of Truma, which would be Sefer Malachim. Okay, last week was also Parshas Zachar, but Sefer Malachim, describing Shlomo's building of the temple, is actually the Haftorah of Truma, Tisisa, Vayakel, and Pekudei. 4 out of 5 weeks in a row all come from Sefer Melachim. That's amazing. We're never aware of it because of those 5 weeks, usually 2 and sometimes 3, are preempted by Shabbos, one of the Parshios. You know, the Dalet Parshios. Right? You hardly ever read Kisisa's Haftorah. It's usually Parshas Parah. We very rarely read of Haftorah of Vayakel or Pekudei, only in leap year, because that's almost always Parshas HaChodesh. And then Truma or Tetzaveh. We never read both Truma and Tetzaveh in a regular year. One of them is certainly one of the four parshas. So these wonderful parshas about the parallels of Shlomo building the Beis HaMikdash, like Kisisa is about Eliyahu, hardly ever get to be read. So Truma is from the Shlomo's description. Tetzaveh is from Yechezkel's description. And let's start. Atah ben Adam, haged es beis Yisrael es habayis v'yikomu mevanusehem umadadu es tavnis. I'm sorry, es tachnis v'nichlamu mikol asher asu tzuras habayis utchunaso umotzaav umovaav v'chol tzurasav v'chol chukosav es tzurasav v'chol tarosav. What a pasuk this is. Hodau samuch sov leineim ishmeru es kol tzurasov es kol chukosav asu osam. Wow. So Yechezkel is verbose. I got to tell you, he repeats himself again and again and again. Some chapters where he says a certain topic and he says it 4, 5, or 6 times in one chapter. Like repetitive pasuk. Okay? So Yechezkel introduces the inyan by saying that I am building a temple so that you can be ashamed of your guilt. In other words, that you can have kapara. Okay? And this is what, one of the main themes of building this temple to Yechezkel is to have a place for you to bring your sacrifices as atonement. Okay, that's what it's all about. And if the atonement is not accompanied by a change in your behavior and the change in what you do outside of this temple, it's all for naught. Okay? Now, it's not in this Haftorah, but it's a little later in Yechezkel where he says, build me this place, v'shochanti b'socham le'olam. And I will reside in your midst forever. But wait a second. This temple that they did build in good faith was destroyed.
Right.
So what do you mean I'll reside in your midst forever?
Right.
So Hashem made a promise to us of residing in our midst, and he didn't keep the promise. He allowed the Romans to destroy it. What's with that? Okay, maybe you want to say he doesn't need a temple to reside in our midst. But Yechezkel seems to be reporting the news that this temple is here to stay. Why wasn't it? Well, because he says, V'shachanti b'socham l'olam v'yikomu mi'amonoseihem, and they'll be ashamed of their sins. The Jews decidedly did not act in a way which demonstrated that they were ashamed of their sins. Okay? So, we're hard-pressed to say that Yechezkel had in mind a third temple. Okay? So he, residing in the Galus, he lived his entire time in exile, entire time of his book at least. He was carried off into the exile of Yehoyachin in 597, 11 years before the Churban, and spoke to Bnei Yisrael from a place called Nahar Kvar. Chazal make a drash that the reason why he was able to give prophecy outside of Israel is because Kvar, he had already given prophecy in Israel. He lived in a city that was later named after a large city in Israel. It's called Tel Aviv. That's the name of the city. He mentions in chapter 2 of his book. And Yechezkel's, I would like to encapsulate Yechezkel's message as follows. He wants to teach Bnei Yisrael that it's possible to lesakein olam b'malchus shakai even without a temple. It's possible to serve God without a temple. It's possible to replace the temple with something called a mikdash ma'at, chapter 10. It's possible to find God even without a centralized place in Yerushalayim, because we can find God in our hearts. And that this is his message. Okay? I must explain to you the message of three other prophets before we can get back to Yechezkel. Those three prophets are often mentioned together like in one breath. And I teach a course in these three prophets all by themselves. It's called Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Okay? I'm going to go backwards. Malachi speaks to Bnei Yisrael during the time of a standing working Beis HaMikdash. The Jews succeeded. They built this place. But they were not doing good work there. Malachi complains bitterly about the people rebuilding the temple that did not do a good job of serving God there. And this Malachi turns a lot of our other prophets on its head, because the other prophets like Hosea, Amos, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, when they spoke words like Lama li rov zivchechem, I don't have any need for your korbanos. Did I command you on korbanos when I took you out of Egypt? I mean, things that seem to defy the logic or defy Pesukim in the Torah. There's such an anathema about the korbanos, because the people bringing the korbanos were not morally just. So the prophet said, your korbanos mean nothing to God in the face of your immorality. Your scrupulous attention to the detail of the ritualistic nature of the korbanos mean nothing to God if you're acting in an immoral fashion. Malachi is exactly the opposite. He does not mention anything about morality or social decay. Or he does complain to the people about their assimilation, right? But he doesn't speak about the moral decay of widows and orphans not being supported and the poor not being freed and the Yovel not being observed and the Shemitah not being observed. He does not deal with those things. Adrabba, he complains to the people. I say it's the opposite. It's the anti-Yeshayahu, because Yeshayahu says, your scrupulous attention to the tale of the korbanos means nothing to God in the face of your morality. While Malachi complains, look how decrepit your service is to me in the temple. Would you bring an offering like that to your governor? Right? Look how you serve God. Okay. I think I wrote in a message a few weeks ago that if Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel, and Amos, and Hosea would come today and see the Jewish community today, I suspect they would be very impressed. They would be very impressed with our Onik Shabbos and our Tomchei Shabbos and our Hatzalah and our Zaka and our Project Renewal and all of our Chesed organizations and amazing, amazing Chesed. In Eretz Yisrael, not even by organizations, by just individuals. Incredible individual chesed. And here too, incredible volunteerism. They would be very impressed. The real question is, and this is especially nogea to COVID, is when Malachi said, you know, you were away from the Beis HaMikdash for so long, now that you're back, it doesn't have the same tom. So people, Jews, have been away from shuls now for almost a year. How will it be for us to get back? Will it be with the same? Will it be so easy to get back? We have to learn things. We have to, right? We have to relearn some things. So that's what Malachi is about, to relearn serving God properly in the temple. It's one of the four topics of Sefer Malachi. Let me go backwards to Zechariah. Zechariah, this is an interesting thing. I'm just pointing it out because we're going to read the Megillah this week. But I just gave a share today on this topic. But Zechariah, I've tried to show, makes a tikkun for seven things that are wrong in Megillat Esther. Right? Shenehenu misudas Achashverosh. They have forgotten about Yerushalayim. Hashem's name isn't mentioned. There doesn't appear to be any nevuah in the book. Right? The Jews have a very precarious life where they can go like just in a split second, pitom, from enjoying the king's protection to being threatened by the king's decree with Haman. Right? That's no way to live, where at any moment you never know such a capricious existence, right? Given to such volatility. It's a very dangerous kind of way to exist, right? So I referred to these problems in Esther and how Zechariah goes one by one to resolve these issues that were so debilitating in Megillas Esther, right? And remember, Esther says that Divrei Shalom Ve'emes is what we're sending around. That comes from Zechariah. He says that all these things, these good things will happen to you if Ve'ha'emes Ve'ha'shalom Ehovu. If you show that you love truth and peace. Okay? So Zechariah is also about returning after the 70 years. Zechariah also makes reference to Yirmiyahu in the 70-year Galus. But I think it's without a doubt that Zechariah's visions go beyond the 70 years, well into the future. According to Abarbanel, into the sailing of the three ships to the New World, which was in his own day. Okay? So that's Zechariah. Now, Haggai. Haggai can be found on page 3. Now, we'll turn to the beginning of Haggai, if you have a full Tanakh. And I circled the psukim of Haggai that we need to do inside. Okay? And this is the second year of Daryavesh. According to Rashi, this is the Daryavesh, that's the son of Achashverosh that we just read about in Daniel. Remember chapter 9? Bishnas Achas the Daryavesh ben Achashverosh. Okay? There are two Dariuses. The other one is the one that threw Daniel into the lion's den. Okay? So Haggai had a calling from Hashem to call together two influential people, Yehoshua Kohen HaKohen HaGadol and Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel. And Hashem tells him, Ko amar Hashem tzvakos lemor, ha'am hazeh amru lo esbo esbo esbeis Hashem libanos. It's not the time to rebuild God's temple. Well, when is? In lo achshav emasai. 70 years are almost over. By the way, we know this time period. The second year of Daryavesh is the year 518 BCE. That means there are just two years left. So why did they say it's not the time? It's not the time to build the Beis HaMikdash. So the Mefarshim go in different directions. One is that we'll start. It's not time. We still have 2 years. Or two is, no. The time to rebuild the temple was... The 70 years were over 20 years ago and nothing happened. So we lost hope. Okay? So Haggai tells them, Ha'amad lachem, ha'es lachem atem lo sheves bevatechem sfunim v'abayis hazeh harev. You're happy to stay in your houses, all guarded and protected and paneled with all kinds of decorations, while my house continues to be in a state of destruction? I tell you that you have to simu levavchem al darchechem, put your hearts to your actions. Zratem arbe v'ave ma'at achol ve'in l'sava shesov ve'in l'shachra levosh ve'in l'chom lo. V'mistaker mistaker al tzror nakuv. He's telling them, I understand you feel you have no resources. You put your salary into a pocket with a hole in it. In other words, not you can't hold on to your wealth. But you know what? It's a catch-22. You say you can't donate to the temple because you don't have the resources. And I tell you, says the prophet, that you don't have the resources because you're not dedicating to the temple. After all, you ever hear of this saying, Liya Kesef for Liya Zahav? You know who's the author of that statement? Liya Kesef, the Liya Zahav Neum Hashem. The silver is mine, the gold is mine. Don't think that you're giving up what's yours. I know you're going to say it's Pirkei Avos, right? Mm-hmm. It's Chagai. It's a pasuk a few psukim from now. Okay? So he says to them, Alu hahar, v'habesem eitz, uvnu abayis, v'ertsebo ve'ekovdo, Mar Hashem. Go up and get the wood. Bring it down. Take it, bring it to Yerushalayim, and I will be appeased by this. I will want it. Ve'ekovda, I will be honored through it. You see the missing hay in the word ve'ekovda in the Masorah? Gemara in Yuma derives from here that there were five things in Bayis Sheni, that Bayis Rishon had that Bayis Sheni was missing. Right? Now that appears to be an admission on the part of the Gemara that Bayis Sheni was not the equivalent of Bayis Rishon. Right? Bayis Sheni was not the same, wasn't as good as Bayis Rishon. Because Bayis Rishon had these five things. Mm. Now, the fact is that if we go over the five things have nothing to do with the temple itself. The five things have to do with things that were in the temple, like the Aron, or the Urim V'Tumim, or the Eish from the Shemayim, or the Ruach HaKodesh. This had nothing to do with the construction and the actual building of the temple. Adrabba. When it comes to the temple, we derive from Chagai. The second one was better than the first. Turn to me, please, to the next page. Where Chagai says in Perek Beis Pasuk Tes, Gadol Yihyeh Kivod Habayit Hazeh Acharon Min HaRishon Amar Hashem Tzvakot. Ubamakom Hazeh Atin Shalom Neum Hashem Tzvakot. Chagai and Zechariah use Hashem's name all over the place. That's one of the tikkunim of not having God's name in Esther and having it all over the place in Chagai and Zechariah. These Nevi'im attempted to fix what was wrong with the Jewish community as is manifest in the book of Esther. Pound for pound, Chagai and Zechariah have more prophecy than any other book in Tanakh, by far. Zechariah is kulo nevuah. The only thing that comes close is Daniel and Yechezkel. Okay. So what does it mean that the glory of the second temple was greater? It will be greater than the first. This comes right after he says, Liya Kesef, Liya Zav. The gold is mine, the silver is mine. For this, we have to turn to Ezra. Okay. Now, I gave you in these sheets Ezra 4 and 5, but we really need to do a little earlier that in Ezra. Because the book of Ezra begins with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. He mentions Chagai and Zechariah as those two Nevi'im responsible for inspiring the people to get involved. Good. Ezra makes specific reference a few times to Chagai and Zechariah. And when they built it, and people started to bring korbanos there, there was a gishrai, a lot of crying from the very old people. What were they crying about? Because they recalled the first temple in their youth. These have to be people in their 80s, 90s. They recall the first temple from their youth and how amazingly different they are. This is nothing, nothing in our eyes, they said. The first temple was so much more glorious than this one. So what does Chagai mean? This temple will be greater than the other one. So the Gemara gives two answers to this question. One, the Gemara with an understatement, by the way, that says that the second temple stood longer than the first. What do I mean by an understatement? Because the Gemara says the second temple stood for 420 years. The first temple stood for 410 years. I say it's an understatement because history shows us that the second temple stood almost 600 years, not 420 years. Okay? I'm just putting that out there. That's for a different time, a different discussion. Rav Shimon Schwab wrote about this and said that's why we have to write in our ksuvas, L'minyan sha'anu monin kan, because we may not be in the right year. The correct year should be 5781 plus 164. That's the year we're in.
So but, we're close to 6,000 years already.
Yeah, that means we're very close to 6,000. Yep.
Then don't go.
I can go for that. All right. So in Ezra chapter 4 and 5, he refers to the permission granted by the Persian kings and the Median kings to rebuild the temple. Now, there's a story there that's quite tragic. It talks about the Shomronim, the Kutim, which could have been some, not could have been, it's stammered by the fact that they called them Shomronim. These were the people that the Assyrians brought in from the exiled lands to live in Israel. After he took the 10 tribes out. You know that that's how the Assyrians conquered. They mixed populations. It's called Bilbul Ha'umot, the displaced people from one place to another. And the people who came to the north of Israel came from a place called Kuta. Hence, we call them Kutim. Kutim became a terminology just for non-Jews later in the Talmud. Right? So these Kutim are called Shomronim here because they lived in Shomron. And these Shomronim wanted a piece of the Mikdash. They wanted a hand in building, rebuilding the Mikdash. Now, chances are they had money. Probably they had resources, right? But I'm not going to second guess Ezra Nehemiah. Ezra Nehemiah refused their help. He said that the task of rebuilding this temple is not for you. It is for people who are part of the Jewish people to begin with. Right? According to our tradition, these people who lived in the north of Israel accepted the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, but they rejected the Torah Shebaal Peh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Camelia, yes, question?
Yeah, I have a question. I think it was in one of the minor prophets. I'm not 100% sure which one, but they mentioned there. And wasn't it that really they had good intentions that to just build the temple, but then they were rejected. And because they were rejected in a way that was hurtful or something, then they sought to get revenge?
So the book you're talking about would not be in Tresa, but our book right here. It's Ezra chapter 4 on page 6 of what I handed out. Read it inside, you'll see. And that rejection did lead to they turned on Ezra's followers. That's why when I started saying this, I said, I'm not going to second guess Ezra and Nehemiah. They just felt that the Shomronim should not be helping us. It is, they did reject them in a way that was dismissive. Maybe they could have been a little more diplomatic and say, oh, that's so good of you. It's so kind of you to want to help us in this difficult time as we're trying to return to our land. But we have a certain dictate from our heavenly instruction that we can't accept your help. Please accept our apologies. Maybe you would like to help us rebuild the museums in Tzfas. I don't know, but whatever it is. But they weren't diplomatic at all. They just dismissed them out and out.
But they should not be, according to their opinion, they were not Jews, as long as you...
Okay, well, whether I don't know whatever Ezra Nehemiah did about the rejection, they turned on them significantly. These Shomronim petitioned the Persian kings to make the Jews stop.
Oh, yeah.
And then they're called the Tzarei Yehuda, and some of Farshim say that Haman was among them. They made similar, you know, this yeah, they helped create Haman here. They said, look, see, the Shomronim themselves don't like the Jews. And those Shomronim lived amongst them. So, to me, it's similar to the these people protesting against Israel and then the apartheid Israel week. These are largely Jews.
Right.
And there are many Jews. Now, see, they're Jews on 96th Street. They have the regular marches against Israel, and they're from Colombia, many of them, and they're coming from different places, and they're Jews. Jewish Voice for Peace, Jewish Voice for Palestine, they're crazy. They're like the Shomronim of Sefer Ezra. And the Shomronim made their peace with Haman, because Haman is called Tzarei Yehudim. They're called Tzarei Yehuda. And it's just a sad note of history that often repeats itself. So, but in the end, Ezra Nehemiah got the upper hand, because then they followed up the Shomronim letter with their own letter to Koresh, who at first rescinded the order, but then allowed the rebuilding to return. In fact, it's Mashma from chapter 5 of Ezra that they didn't even wait for permission to return to continue building. You know, it says we heard from Haggai and Zechariah, and they were granted the permission this time.
Nehemiah
had
more flour.
I'm sorry?
He said Nehemiah, when he came already with a letter from the king.
Yeah, that's
much
so that's
more our political power.
That's Artaxasta, yes.
Later on.
Yes. So the Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Rosh Hashanah is like throws up its arms with a lot of this confusion. Who's giving permission? In Ezra, it's Koresh. And then it's Daryavesh. And in Nehemiah, it's Artaxasta. So the Gemara says, who Koresh, who Daryavesh, who Artaxasta? It's all the same person. Wow. Now, the fact is that the Persians, if you look at the names of their kings, there were four Artaxastas, right? There were two Dariuses, right? There was only one Cyrus, but okay. Might have been numerous personalities here. Okay, so Haggai then asks the people a question. You're ready to build this temple? You're ready to go back and so he asked them two questions. I think I made reference to this question once before. He asked them two questions. One is, if you have a piece of tumadika meat that's wrapped in a garment and that touches something else, does it transfer the tumah? And the answer is yes. And then they asked another question, but you have to know a fact first, is that in the Torah, if kachim meat touches other meat, it makes it to have the equal status. Okay. Now, in most cases, you're not allowed to take the kutcher meat out of its precincts to touch your pastrami sandwich. But if somehow a chatas touched your pastrami sandwich, then what's the halacha? Only a kohen can eat it. He has to eat it that day. Right? You get what I'm saying? You have to treat it like a chatas. So then Haggai asked the second question. If a piece of chatas meat was wrapped in a garment and it touched a pastrami sandwich, does it make the sandwich to be chatas meat? And the answer there is no. What's the musar?
No.
So on the face of it, it could be that he was just asking the mishaila to know, because he says, Sha'al na esakalanim Torah lemor. Torah. It's not just a test. It's a Dvar Torah. It's this. There's something to it, right? So did they know the answer? According to the simple pshat, they got both answers right. The end of the first parak in Maseches Psachim is a very difficult sugya, discusses this from a different standpoint. They say that they got only one of the questions right. Yishtabish Kahani, remember Rav and Shmuel? But the Musar is pretty clear. And in fact, according to the Ibn Ezra, the Musar is to convince the Jews not to let those Shomronim help us rebuild the temple. Because it's harder to spread Tahara than to spread Tumah. Tumah spreads more readily. It'll spread through the garment. Tahara needs to touch directly. And if you let those Shomronim help you rebuild the temple, they're going to exact their pound of flesh. And they're going to insist on having a say in how the temple is rebuilt and how the temple should be run. So according to the Ibn Ezra, this whole point of this test is to give them a symbolic message about accepting help or not accepting help from the Shomronim. Okay, that's enough of our background. Let's get back into Yechezkel. Okay. Like the Torah reading, the Haftorah is extremely dry. Extremely dry. It's one of the most boring Haftorahs of the entire year. No, I just say it's just a bunch of facts. It's a bunch of lists and you can say that it's symbolic of certain things, and okay, fair enough, but he makes certain references, like the Mizbeach is called an Ariel, it like pounces on what you put on it, like a lion does, right? Okay. And it spends most of its time describing the workings of the Mizbeach. For after all, the whole point of the Mishkan, all right, there's a menorah, there's a shulchan, there's an aron, there are furnishings, there's very nice trappings. But the whole, the whole thing is about what you put on the Mizbeach. Okay? Now, it's true that there's something called the Ketores. Right, that's the other Mizbeach, the two Mizbeachos, one for animal sacrifice and one for the daily incense. And sometimes, Rosh Chodesh, Chagim, Yom Kippur, sometimes there's some blood offerings on the four corners of that smaller indoor Mizbeach. Okay. All right, and of course, since Yechezkel himself is a Kohen, so some of this Haftorah does refer to elements of Kehuna, which is more important because Tetzaveh is the Kohen's Parsha. Now you can say, good Shabbos. Every Parsha that has to do with the Mishkan is the Kohen's Parsha, right? But Tetzaveh much more than Truma, which may explain in Pshat why Moshe's name doesn't appear. He's not the Kohen, right? Moshe said, God, take my name from your book if you don't forgive them for the Egel. Or he also said, take my name from the book because this is my brother's Parsha. I'm getting all the glory and let him have his Parsha. I don't have to be mentioned in this Parsha. If you want to call me God, just say V'ata Tetzaveh Es B'nei Yisrael, right? There's no doubt that Moshe's name is purposely missing from this Parsha. It's by no means the only parsha in the Torah like that. It's the only parsha from Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar like that. Moshe's name does not appear at all in Bereishis, and only twice in Sefer Devarim. Okay? Okay? There's another parsha where Moshe's name is only mentioned once, at the very end of the parsha. And because you might have had a havamina that Moshe had no say in this parsha, the Gemara in the first bibliography, the oldest bibliography in the world, that refers to the authors of the books of the Torah, of the Tanakh, says, Moshe kosav sifro uparshas bilam. Moshe's name only appears once in all Parsha. Whoa, what does Moshe have to do? Moshe has nothing to do with the Bilam story. Right? Moshe's only mentioned in the end when he comes to get exacting vengeance on what Bilam wrought against us. Okay? All right, So this is why Tetzaveh's Haftorah concentrates mostly on the workings of the Mizbeach and the actual workings of the Kohen. Mm-hmm. All right, the Kohen is the only one who can approach the Mizbeach. Some of the other things that are done in there can be done by non-Kohanim too. You don't need a Kohen to do the Shechita. Okay. But the work of the Mizbeach is the Kohen's work, and that's what Tetzaveh is. Sefer Shmos is necessary, at least the relationship of these two brothers is a necessary aspect of cleansing the pathologies of Sefer Bereishis. We have all the sibling rivalries, especially of a younger brother besting an older brother and the older brother not taking that kindly and not taking it well. When Ephraim and Menashe seem to make their peace, even though in all the other cases in Bereishis, the younger brother prevails because of something that he's already done. In the case of Ephraim and Menashe, the younger brother prevails because of something that's going to be. Yaakov tells Yosef, Yodati b'ni Yodati, he's just going to be greater. So I can understand Menashe saying, but that's not fair. Why should I suffer because of something my descendants are going to do? And why should he gain because of something his descendants are going to do? What does that have to do with today? Right? So, but it's only Yosef who complains. Apparently Menashe didn't. And that sets the stage for the two brothers in Shmos, Moshe and Aaron, where again the younger brother prevails. The younger brother doesn't win out, but he becomes greater. Right? And here, because Aaron is happy, not only does he accept it, he's happy with it. Right. So Moshe wants to return the favor somewhat here by giving him his own parasha and telling God, keep my name out of it. Okay? All right, so here in the Haftorah, Yechezkel mentions a new family. It's called Mizera Tzadok HaKrovim Elai. The Tzadok family was from Elazar HaKohen. Eli's family was from Itamar. Nadav and Avihu were killed, who died, of course. And then there were two other sons of Aaron, Elazar and Itamar. So at first, the Kehuna Gedola went through Itamar. Right? Eli was from Itamar. As it says in Divrei Yamim, but Elazar's descendants were Tzadok. How did Tzadok get to be the Kohen Gadol? Because when Eli's great-great-grandson made the tactical error of siding with Adoniyahu instead of Shlomo, Shlomo banished that person, Eviatar, to a city called Anatot to live out his life there because you're not serving me in the temple. To fulfill, the narrator says in Melachim Aleph, Perek Gimel, to fulfill the promise, Perek Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, to fulfill the promise that God made to Eli that your descendants won't serve me in the temple. So it's not Itamar's family, it's Elazar's family, it's not Eviatar, it's Tzadok. That's our Tzadok here in the Haftorah. Pasuk Yutes, he says, Nasatar la kohanim halviim asher hem mizerat tzadok hakrovim elaynu Hashem Elokim l'shur seini parben bakar l'chatas. So he refers to these are references to the like the initiation of the kohen into the service. Okay. Oh, you need. Okay, that is. Is basically the Haftorah. It's a simple one. It's a rare one. And it just basically concentrates on this third temple Now, it's the third temple according to Abarbanel. It's the second temple according to Ibn Ezra. Rashi makes peace between these two opinions. Mm-hmm. You know how? Because Rashi says that Yechezkel meant for it to refer to the second temple, but Shegoram Achet, but because the Jews sinned in Roman times to deserve for it to be destroyed, then all of the second temple prophecies of Yechezkel roll over to the third temple. You see, Chagai said, Gedol Yehye Kivod Habayit Hazeh Ha'acharon Min Arishon. Wait a second, this is not the Acharon. This is the second temple, not the last one. Christians point to this pasuk as a sign that we're wrong in hoping for a third temple. Mm. Let me tell you why they're wrong. Because Acharon does not mean last. Can you think of two pasukim in the Torah where it means the latter, not the last? It says that Yaakov presented his family to Esav. First, he presented the children of the two Shvachos, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, and their mothers. And listen carefully, then it says, V'leya ubanav acharonim. And then it says again, Rochel, Yosef, Rochel, acharonim. What do we see from here?
Another meaning.
That acharon does not necessarily mean the final one. Is the latter one, right? Okay. Also, when Hashem showed Moshe three different signs, he said to them, the first sign is a stick turning to a snake, the second sign is his hand turning to be leprous, and the third sign is blood turning into water. And Hashem tells Moshe, Im lo yishma'u l'kol ha'ot harishon, Yishma'u l'kol ha'ot ha'acharon. V'im lo yishma'u l'kol... Wait, what do you mean? Lo yishma'u l'kol ha'ot ha'acharon, and then they'll listen to the third one. If acharon, there is no one after that. So kamash malam, acharon does not necessarily mean the last. So when Chagai said, Gedol yekavod abayit hazeh acharon, he didn't mean the last one. He mean the second one. Abarbanel answers, he says, no. He meant by shlishi. Right? It's probably polemic against Christians to say that. Okay. All right, Chevra, b'mheir v'yameinu, like the Rambam says, we'll use Yechezkel also to help us with the instruction of building Beis HaMikdash. Next week we have a...
Yechezkel...
I'm sorry, Chava?
I said Yechezkel's job was to make sure that the even though we are in galut, that we don't forget that we still belong to Hashem. So his job, he can't say, you are just about, you have to build this Mishavikdash and it's not going to last. I mean, you have to be positive. You have to, his job was to make sure that they are approaching it, you know, with a positive attitude. And not talk about the third Beit HaMikdash before the second one is even built.
That's the pshat. It's just that some prophecies, especially in Chagai, especially some in Yechezkel, seem to make reference to something in the distant future. So is the distant future something happening soon? Like in, you know, Daniel? Or can it be rolled over to refer to something in the distant future? I mean, that hasn't even happened yet in our time, that we're still waiting for it to take place. So that's the debate here.
Rabbi Schwartz, one thing. There should be the second temple, at least the next temple, should be somehow different in something from the first one, as long as the first one was crushed, was destroyed. And it doesn't appear, it doesn't look that it appears anywhere. Because, which is strange, the service, everything was exactly the same. And not only the service, practical service, but the ideas were exactly the same. So what was it? a desire to repeat once again a little bit better experiment than it was with the first temple.
Well, we have our traditions.
It wasn't built exactly the same. The dimensions that are totally different.
We have our traditions. We have our the dimensions. Even some of the furnishings were much bigger and not the same.
Dimensions are different. In Yecheskel from the first temple, from Shlomo's temple.
No, there is a museum in the old city that tries to put forth. Now it's in, I think it's in the Sfarim store when you get up to the steps in the Rova, in the Jewish quarter. So it's hard to come up with these things because there's so many different opinions today of the size of the Amma. We don't know how big to make these things, right? But they're different, very different shittos. So I guess if anybody can convince all the Jews in the world to agree with one thing, that in itself will be a sign that Mashiach is here, right?
It'll be a miracle.
Well, I just want to say that the next effort was not accepted at all. Probably the Jews could not offer God anything interesting. You see, because Bar Kokhba's rebellion was lost absolutely.
There is archaeological evidence that during the time of the Bar Kokhba revolts, they did start rebuilding the temple.
Exactly, right. But nothing happened after.
No. As it turns out, the Bar Kokhba revolts were disastrous. Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody have a great week. Next week we'll do the Haftorah of Parshas Parah. Mm-hmm. And... Right, Parshas Para is next week. Yeah, and then Parshas Achodesh. Yes.
Of course. What do we have on Wednesday? Wednesday
is Minchas Chinuch. We do the mitzvahs of the Torah. We're up to mitzvah number 16.
You're doing it on Wednesday. Yes.
Wednesday nights, yes.
Also 8 o'clock?
8 o'clock.
Also Zoom, right? I just could not understand. That's why I'm
8 o'clock, Mitzvah Shem.
Okay.
Everybody have a good night.
Rabbi, when you record these, where are the recordings posted?
Thank you.
They usually go right onto something called yutorah.org. Yutorah, TORAH.org. Okay, everybody, have a great night.